On Thursday, the 29th day of May, 1533, Lady Anne Boleyn, Marquess of Pembroke, was received as Queen by all the Lords of England. And on Saturday, the last day of May, she rode from the Tower of London through the city with a goodly company of lords, knights, and gentlemen richly apparelled. She herself riding in a chariot covered with cloth of silver and a canopy of cloth of silver borne over her head. Four chariots with ladies followed after her, richly behanged, and also divers other ladies and gentlewomen riding on horseback, all in gowns made of crimson velvet. The first day of June, Queen Anne was brought from Westminster Hall with all the monks of Westminster going in copes of gold, with 13 abbots mitred, and after them all the king's chapel in rich copes with 4 bishops and 2 archbishops, and all the lords in their parliament robes. The crown was borne before her by the Duke of Suffolk, and her 2 sceptres by 2 earls. She herself went under a rich canopy of cloth of gold, apparelled in a kirtle of crimson velvet, and a robe of purple velvet furred with powdered ermines, and a rich coronet with a caul of pearls on her head. And so was she brought to the Abbey of St. Peter's at Westminster, and there she was anointed and crowned by the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Archbishop of York.
For 6 years, Anne Boleyn had worked towards this moment, described by the Windsor Herald Charles Wroxley, playing a difficult and dangerous game with cold-blooded skill and courage. For her sake, Henry VIII had repudiated Catherine of Aragon, for 20 years his faithful and devoted wife. He had defied the Pope and insulted the Emperor Charles V, Catherine's nephew, and the most powerful monarch in Europe. Henry's desire for Anne Boleyn and his desperate need of a son had overridden every obstacle in his path, and there had been many. Catherine had fought every step of the way to defend her marriage, and even now, in loneliness, humiliation, and apparent defeat, she was still fighting. To every statesman in Europe, Anne was the concubine. The people of England called her by less diplomatic names, but now she was riding high. The previous winter, judging her moment to a nicety, she had surrendered to the king's long siege. Sometime in the early spring, she and Henry had been secretly married by Thomas Cranmer, the new Archbishop of Canterbury, by whose authority the king's first marriage was declared null and void. It was now generally known that Anne was pregnant. If she could only bear a healthy son, she would be safe. And the tremendous gamble which had brought the former maid of honor to the highest place in the land would have finally succeeded. Meanwhile, the heiress of England, only surviving child of Henry and Catherine of Aragon, Mary Tudor, Princess of Wales, now just 17 years old, could only watch in helpless rage and misery as the wicked flourished and her mother's persecutors triumphed. And then, as Charles Wroxley wrote in his chronicle,
"The 7th day of September, 1533, being Sunday, Queen Anne was brought to bed of a fair daughter at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The Wednesday next following, the most honourable young lady was christened at Greenwich in the Friars' Church, and there she had given her to name Elizabeth. And the morrow after, there was bonfires made in London, and at every fire a vessel of wine for the people to drink."
Henry put the best face he could on his disappointment, but it was a grievous blow. He'd made enemies abroad and offended his subjects at home, all for another useless girl. Englishmen were now beginning to realize the full consequences of the church's loss of independence from the power of the state, which had resulted from the king's break with Rome. And many of them didn't like what they saw. Henry's discarded wife and elder daughter stubbornly refused to recognize either the validity of his divorce, which by implication made Mary illegitimate, or his new title of Supreme Head of the Church in England. Catherine and Mary were both objects of considerable popular sympathy, and while they continued to resist, would be the natural rallying point for disaffection. At all costs, their resistance must be broken. It was on Mary that the full brunt of the persecution fell. She was still officially heir to the throne, and her submission would be the most valuable. An indication of what was to come was contained in a dispatch from Eustace Chapuis, ambassador of the Emperor Charles V and devoted friend and champion of both Catherine and Mary. Writing to his master on September the 15th, he commented somewhat spitefully,
"The christening ceremony of this king's bastard daughter was as dull and disagreeable as the mother's coronation. Neither at court nor in the city of London has there been the rejoicings customary on such occasions." Immediately after the christening, a herald, standing at the gate of the church, proclaimed her Princess of England. The same herald also announced that the good, true, and legitimate princess was no longer to be called so. In fact, a rumor is afloat, and not without foundation, that her household and allowance are shortly to be reduced. May God in his infinite mercy prevent still worse treatment.
A few days later, Lord Hussey, newly appointed chamberlain to Mary, wrote to the council.
"According to the king's commandment, showed me at Greenwich on Sunday last, I have signified to the princess his pleasure concerning the diminishing of her dignity as Princess of Wales. She was much astonished at my declaring such a thing, without authorization or other writing from the king, not doubting that she is the king's lawful daughter and heir. She will not believe that the king intends to diminish her estate without a writing from him. I therefore commit the matter to your lordships to be further weighed."
An order now came that Mary was to leave the pleasant manor of Beaulieu at Newhall in Essex, where she was then living. She took the opportunity of writing personally to her father.
"This morning my chamberlain informed me that he had received letters from the controller of your grace's house, to the effect that I should remove at once to Hertford Castle. I desired to see the letter in which was written the Lady Mary, the King's daughter, leaving out the name of Princess. I marvelled at this, thinking your Highness was not privy to it, for I doubt not but you take me for your lawful daughter, born in true matrimony. If I agreed to the contrary, I should offend God. In all other things, your Highness shall find me an obedient daughter."
Henry lost no time in destroying any illusions Mary might be cherishing. A deputation comprising the Earls of Oxford, Essex, and Sussex, and the Dean of the King's Chapel, was sent to visit her at Newhall, bearing with them the following document.
"Articles to be showed on our behalf and to our daughter, the Lady Mary, by our right trusty and well-beloved counsellors. The king is surprised to be informed, both by Lord Hussey's letters and by his said daughter's own, that she, forgetting her filial duty and allegiance, attempts, in spite of the commandments given her by Lord Hussey and by the letters of the controller of the household, arrogantly to usurp the title of princess, declaring that she cannot in conscience think but that she is the king's lawful daughter, born in true matrimony, and believes the king in his own conscience thinks the same. The said counsellors have been commanded to declare to her the folly and danger of her conduct, and how the king intends that she shall use herself both as to her title and her household. That she has worthily deserved the king's high displeasure and punishment by law, but that on her conforming to the king's will, he may incline of his fatherly pity to promote her welfare."
Mary would not conform, and shortly afterwards left Newhall. Her household was reduced, but she still had some old friends with her. Then, early in November, Chapuys reported to the emperor.
"Not content with having taken away from his own legitimate daughter the name and title of princess, the king has even gone so far as to demand that she should go and live as maid of honour to his base-born daughter. As your majesty may guess, both the queen and princess are marvellously disturbed and sent to me about a week ago for advice in this trouble. I immediately dispatched to the princess a protest drawn in due form, which she should sign and keep by her, declaring that neither by word nor deed, expressly nor tacitly, has she ever consented to anything that may prejudice her or her right."
Chapuys also sent Mary a form of verbal protest, which she was to learn by heart and repeat before witnesses if the need arose. In this way, Although he could do little to protect her personally, Chapuys hoped to preserve her legal rights. Catherine and Mary were forbidden to communicate with each other, but somehow they managed to maintain a secret correspondence. The letters were left undated for greater safety, but during this time of unknown fears, rumors, and threats, it seems most likely that Mary received this letter from her mother.
Daughter, I heard such tidings today that I do perceive, if they be true, the time is come that Almighty God will prove you. And I am very glad of it, for I trust he doth handle you with a good love. I beseech you, agree to his pleasure with a merry heart, and be sure that without fail he will not suffer you to perish, if you beware to offend him. If this lady do come to you as it is spoken, if she do bring you a letter from the king, I am sure in this letter you shall be commanded what you shall do. Obey the king your father in everything. Save only that you do not offend God and lose your own soul, and go no further with disputation in the matter. Speak few words, and meddle nothing. I will send you 2 books in Latin, and in them I trust you shall see good things. And sometimes, for recreation, use your virginals, or lute, if you have any. But one thing especially I desire of you, for the love you do owe unto God and unto me, to keep your heart with a chaste mind, and your body from all ill and wanton company, not thinking of nor desiring any husband. Neither determine yourself to any manner of living until this troublesome time be past, for I dare make sure that you shall see a very good end. I would God, good daughter, that you did know with how good a heart I write this letter unto you, for I perceive very well that God loveth you. And now you shall begin, and by likelihood I shall follow. I set not a rush by it, but when they have done the uttermost they can, then I am sure of the amendment. Daughter, wheresoever you become, take no pains to send to me, for if I may, I will send to you. By your loving mother, Catherine the Queen.
On the 16th of December, the baby Princess Elizabeth was taken ceremoniously through London on her way to Hatfield, where a separate household had been set up for her. The following day, the Duke of Norfolk, who was a kinsman of Anne Boleyn, visited Mary.
Madam, I have come to declare unto you the king's pleasure, which is that you should make ready at once to attend the court and enter the service of his majesty's daughter, the Princess of Wales.
That is a title, my lord, which belongs to me by right, and to none other. What you propose to me in the king's name seemeth strange and dishonorable.
I have not come hither to dispute with you, madam, but to see the king's will accomplished.
Since my father is so pleased, I will not disobey his commandments. But I beg you to intercede with his highness that the services of many well-deserving and trusty officers of my household here may be rewarded, and that 1 year's wages at least may be given them.
No doubt the king, in his wisdom, will make full provision, madam.
How many of my own people may go with me to this place?
2 maids only will suffice. You will find plenty to attend on you, whither you are going.
The Countess of Salisbury, for many years Mary's lady governess and devoted friend, offered to go with her and bring servants at her own expense. But Norfolk would not allow it. Mary was to have no one who might strengthen her resistance or smuggle letters and news to and from the outside world. The journey through the bleak winter landscape must have been wretched. Mary remembered her father as a gay, affectionate figure who had once teased her at some solemn state function by pulling off her cap so that her long, fair hair tumbled down her back. Like Catherine, Mary had no hesitation in ascribing her present misfortunes entirely to the malign influence of Anne Boleyn. And now she was going to live surrounded by Anne's friends and relations. But when they arrived at Hatfield, Mary showed the Duke of Norfolk that she was not defeated.
Do you not wish to pay your respects to the princess, madam?
I know of no other princess in England except myself, my lord. The daughter of Madame of Pembroke has no such title. But if the King's Grace acknowledges her as his daughter, I will be pleased to call her sister.
What message shall I carry to the King from you, madam?
None, save that the Princess of Wales, his daughter, asked for his blessing.
I tell you plainly, madam, I dare not take any such words to His Highness.
Then you may go away and leave me alone.
For the next 3 years, Mary was to know what it meant to be truly alone. At Hatfield, she was so closely shut up that she couldn't even go to Mass at the nearby church. It was said that Anne Boleyn had sent a message to Lady Shelton, who was in charge of the household, bidding her give Mary a box on the ears now and then for the cursed bastard she was. To the English people, Mary became a legendary princess, imprisoned by a wicked stepmother, and whenever the local country folk caught a glimpse of her, they waved their caps and shouted their loyalty. According to Chapuis, she had been given the worst room in the house and was forced to take all her meals in the crowded great hall. The two ladies she'd brought with her had been dismissed, and her only attendant was a chambermaid who was not even ordered to taste her food. Chapuis lost no opportunities of protesting to the king and to Thomas Cromwell, former moneylender and soldier of fortune, now Chief Secretary of State, a cunning, unscrupulous politician, and as powerful as ever the great Cardinal Wolsey had been. He got little satisfaction, however, and for the most part could only stand by, helplessly indignant, reporting each fresh enormity to his master.
The king lately went to visit his bastard daughter Elizabeth and the Princess Mary also. One of the principal causes of his going was to persuade or force the princess to renounce her title. But the Lady Anne, fearing the king's weakness, and that the beauty and virtue of the princess might soften her father's anger and cause him to treat her more kindly, sent messengers after the king to prevent him seeing or speaking with her. Accordingly, before arriving at the house, he gave orders that she was not to come to him. Instead, Cromwell and the captain of the guard were sent to urge the princess to renounce her title. She replied that she had already given her answer, and it was labor wasted to press her. They were deceived if they thought that bad treatment, rudeness, or even death would make her change her mind. While the king was with his new daughter, the princess begged leave to come and kiss his hand, but her request was refused. When the king was about to mount his horse and ride away, she went to a terrace at the top of the house to see him. The king, either being told of it or by chance, turned round, and seeing her on her knees with her hands joined, bowed to her and put his hand to his hat. Then all those present, who had not dared to raise their heads to look at her, saluted her reverently with signs of goodwill and compassion.
Parliament met in January 1534 and at once set to work to destroy all traces of papal power and influence. No more payments of annates or Peter's pence were to be made to Rome. No more appeals were to be made to the ecclesiastical courts and thence to the Pope. Instead, all such cases would be decided in Chancery. In future, all bishops would be appointed by the king. The old heresy laws were repealed, and people encouraged to speak aloud against the usurped power of the Bishop of Rome. Parliament was still sitting when at long last the Pope pronounced judgment on the King's divorce. He decided in Catherine's favor, declaring that her marriage to Henry was and always had been good and lawful. Almost simultaneously, an act was passed at Westminster bastardizing Mary, excluding her from the succession, and entailing the crown on the children of Anne Boleyn. Before they were allowed to leave for their homes, every member of Parliament was sworn to this act. Nor was that enough, as Charles Wroxley noted in his chronicle.
All the crafts in London were summoned to their halls, and there were sworn on a book to be true to Queen Anne, and to take her for the lawful wife of the king and rightful Queen of England, and utterly to think the Lady Mary but as a bastard, and thus to do without any scruple of conscience. Also all the priests in London and throughout England were sworn, before the Lord of Canterbury and other bishops, and all counties in England were sworn, likewise, every man in the shires and towns where they dwelled.
Now that Mary had been officially disinherited, the household at Hatfield grew bolder, and in March, Chapuys was horrified to hear that actual physical violence had been used against her.
Last Thursday, Your Majesty's cousin, the Princess, refused to accompany this king's bastard daughter on her removal to another house, and was put by force by certain gentlemen into a litter with the aunt of the king's mistress, thus being compelled to pay court to the bastard. She made a public protest at the compulsion used, so that her act, being involuntary, should not prejudice her right and title. I would not have advised the princess to go to this extreme, for fear of irritating her father, and consequently suffering worse treatment at the desire of his mistress, who is continually plotting against her. But the Queen and others have lately thought it better to show the King their teeth a little. I am afraid this will do harm.
Sometime that spring, the royal commissioners visited Elizabeth's household to exact the oath of succession. Mary, of course, refused it. And now, when the King came to see his baby daughter, she was locked in her room with a guard at the door. At this time, Mary had no means of getting in touch with Chapuys, the only person who could help her. But desperation sharpened her wits, as Chapuys presently reported.
The princess asked to see a physician then in the house who had once been her tutor, but this was refused. Upon which she found means of communicating with him without raising suspicion. For she began before all present to tell him that she had been so long without speaking Latin that she could hardly say two words correctly. Upon the physician addressing her in that language, she said to him, knowing that no one in the room could understand, that the king had been heard to say that he would have her beheaded for disobeying the laws of the kingdom. The physician was much astonished and knew not what to answer, except that the princess's Latin was not very good, and he could not understand it. Nevertheless, he contrived to send me a message immediately.
Although Chapuys continued to fear the worst, Mary's treatment improved slightly during the summer. She was allowed more attendant and was able to reopen her channels of communication with the ambassador. But she'd learnt the lesson of distrust so thoroughly that she believed it only a device to lull her suspicions and make it easier to poison or otherwise dispose of her. She told Chapuys her only hope was to die. In August, the household was on the move again, this time to Richmond. And once more, the problem of precedence had to be faced. Once more, Mary turned to Chapuys.
The princess, understanding that the king intended her to follow the bastard wherever she might go, sent to me three times in less than 24 hours to know what to do. I wrote back to her each time, resolving her scruples, that even if she did obey the king in this respect without opposition, it could not prejudice the protestations already made. I thought that she should speak boldly, but not go to the extremity of allowing herself to be again taken by force. On her coming to the door of the lodging, there was the litter of the bastard, and the princess was compelled to go out after her. However, as soon as she was mounted, the controller allowed her to go before or after as she pleased. She pushed forward and made such haste that she arrived at Greenwich about an hour before the bastard. When she came to the barge, she took care to secure the most honourable place. I had intimated to her that I would willingly go to Greenwich to see her pass, and she sent to beg me to do so. I was there, accordingly, in disguise, and it was a great pleasure to see such excellent beauty, accompanied by heroic bearing, which all the more increased the pity of seeing her so treated.
But for all her brave show, the continual strain was telling on Mary, and soon after she became so ill that the king's physician went to see her. Dr. Butts, a sensible, kindly man, suggested she should be sent to her mother, whose own doctor could attend her and could hardly be suspected of trying to poison her. Catherine must have heard of this, and snatching at the sudden glimmer of hope, she wrote to Chapuise.
My especial friend, I have been told that the princess, my daughter, is ill, and I suspect she is much worse than they say. I beg you will go to the king and desire him on my behalf to do such a charity as to send his daughter and mine where I am, because tending her with my own hands, if God please to take her from his world, my heart will rest satisfied. Otherwise, in great pain. You shall say to His Highness that there is no need of any other person but myself to nurse her, that I will put her in my own bed and watch over her when needful.
But Henry would not do such a charity. If Mary were allowed to join her mother, her resistance would inevitably be strengthened. Thomas Cromwell, a far-sighted man, who never entirely discounted the possibility that Mary might one day be reinstated, persuaded the king to compromise. Hearing of Cromwell's good offices, Catherine wrote to him.
My good friend, you have laid me under great obligation by the trouble you have taken in speaking to the king, my lord, about the coming of my daughter to me. I hope God will reward you. As you know, it is out of my power to give you anything but my goodwill. As to the answer given you, that the king is content to send her to some house near me, provided I do not see her, I beg you will give him hearty thanks. You may assure him that if she were but a mile from me, I would not see her. And if I wished it, I have not the means. Howbeit, you shall say to His Highness that it was my wish that he should send our daughter where I am, being assured that a little comfort and mirth which she would have with me would be half her cure. As my request was so just and reasonable, I did not think it would be denied. I have heard His Highness had some suspicion of her security, a thing so far from reason that I cannot believe it entered his heart. Neither can I think that he hath so little confidence in me. I pray you, say unto His Highness that I henceforth offer my person as surety. And if any such thing be attempted, he may do justice upon me as the most traitorous woman alive.
Chapuis had, in fact, been investigating for some time the possibility of getting Mary out of the country. Whether Catherine knew of this or not, she must certainly have realized that Mary's safety was of the utmost importance, for in her eventual succession to the throne lay the only hope of restoring the old faith. Events were now taking place which grieved and shocked both mother and daughter and all who believed in the divine origin of the Pope's authority. Early in 1535, Thomas Cromwell was appointed Vicar General to visit monasteries and churches and guide the clergy along the path of obedience, with particular emphasis on their unconditional acceptance of the King as supreme head of the Church. To those who hesitated, an awful example was soon forthcoming. In May, the prior and some of the monks of Charterhouse suffered the horrible death of common traitors. In June, John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, was executed. And in July, Thomas More, once Chancellor of England and friend of the King and a scholar renowned all over Europe, followed him to the block. For the first time, men were being persecuted not for following strange gods and new religions, but for upholding the beliefs they and their ancestors had been taught in childhood from time immemorial. Throughout that wet and dismal summer, with the prospect of a bad harvest to come, mutterings of discontent were clearly audible. Not only the commons, but many of the nobility, among them some of the king's own companions, were alarmed and disgusted at the way things were going. But no leader appeared. The spark to light the fire would have to come from abroad. Chapuys had long been urging his master to act, but Charles was a prudent man, unwilling to commit himself to such a risky undertaking. Thomas Cromwell, cynic and realist, was aware of the danger, however, as he admitted in conversation with Chapuys.
Master Ambassador, intelligences have been received from various quarters, although I attach no faith to them, that the Emperor plans to introduce dissension into this kingdom and then invade it with an army. Yet the enterprise would not be so easy or inexpensive as people may imagine. And even if His Majesty were to conquer this country, it would not redound to his honor so to have treated such a true and old friend as the king my master has been to him.
Master Secretary, whence have you these intelligences? And what is meant by dissension?
There has been talk in Flanders and in Spain of forbidding English merchants to trade with the Emperor's dominions, and thus to incite the people of this realm to rise in rebellion. I will not conceal from you, Master Ambassador, that such a measure might be very effective were it carried into execution.
You may assure your master that His Imperial Majesty desires nothing so much as that peace and harmony should prevail among all the Christian princes. But, as a good Catholic, he cannot but obey the judgment of the Pope in the matter of the king's marriage. Nor can he remain indifferent to the condition of the queen and princess, his aunt and cousin.
The effect of a great many advantages is suspended merely through the Emperor's respect and affection for the Lady Mary, who is but mortal and now in delicate health. If it should please God to take her to himself, there would be no further cause for quarrel and dissension. Whatever people might say or think, would the Emperor, I ask you, have reason to regret her death?
Master Secretary, as we are just now trying to bring about a closer union between our masters, I will not waste time by representing the great dangers and inconveniences likely to arise were the princess to die suddenly in these times and in a manner so open to suspicion. God forbid that such a thing should come to pass.
Oh, man.
Besides, how could my master clear himself of the infamy of an imputation that in order to secure a treaty, he had consented to his own cousin's death and had sold her life to obtain peace in exchange?
You can have no idea, Master Ambassador, of the importunity with which the French are assailing the king, my master, to join them in a war against the Emperor, using all the time most persuasive arguments. They point out the facility with which your master's dominions might be assailed from various sides if they could only count upon our assistance. But it is my master's wish to be able to bring about a true and perfect union among the Christian princes. And although the French are making unparalleled offers to draw the king into this war, we will not listen to them.
Since the king has, by his virtue and wisdom, decided not to join the French, it is unnecessary for me to enter into discussion with you on this matter, Master Cromwell. I might otherwise have pointed out what expense the king would have been put to, and what damage his own interest and reputation would have suffered. For he himself has owned to me that he knows that all the bravados and threats of the French have no other object than the advancement of their ambitions in Italy. I do not forbear to praise your master's virtuous intentions, and would count myself the happiest of men were I able to assist in bringing them about.
In truth, Master Ambassador, it is the Lady Mary who is the obstacle to all peaceful negotiations. There is nothing so troublesome in the settling of affairs between the king, my master, and the emperor, as this business of the ladies It ought not to be allowed to interfere with matters of so weighty a nature and so important in their results. It must be remembered that the mother is old and will not live long, and the Lady Mary in such bad health that her early death seems probable. Besides which, it does not seem as if there were much concern regarding them, either in France or Spain.
Then I can only believe that the King's ambassadors have misunderstood the whole affair. If they have written that the Emperor is content for the Queen and Princess to remain in their present plight. I assure you, Master Cromwell, that should anything happen to either one or both the ladies, which God forbid, it could mar all the good for which your master is working. And many who are now asleep might then bestir themselves.
Although the Emperor shrank from the idea of an armed invasion, he had for some time been trying to rescue his cousin by arranging a foreign marriage for her. But unfortunately, as Henry was not slow to point out, Mary was not in the Emperor's power to bestow, and all the negotiations came to nothing. Indeed, Chapuis soon became convinced that Henry did not intend to allow his daughter to marry anybody. Small wonder that Mary yearned for escape. Chapuis had already reported to his master that he thought it would be possible to get the princess away, provided she was living somewhere close to London and provided an oared boat, independent of the tides and strong enough to fight off pursuit, was available to convey her to the mouth of the Thames, where one of the Emperor's ships would be waiting for her. In the spring of 1535, it seemed as if the opportunity had come.
The princess remained some 10 days at Greenwich after the bastard Elizabeth was removed thence. As one of your Majesty's galleons was on the other side of the river, together with some other Spanish ships, by means of which the princess might be saved, I sent to her to know if she would agree to it. She gave ready ear to the suggestion, saying she desired nothing else, and has since sent 2 or 3 times to solicit the matter. But her sudden departure to another house broke off the enterprise, to which also I did not dare commit myself, not having commandment from your Majesty. Nevertheless, the princess continues in her purpose, and has sent to desire me, for the love of God, to contrive to remove her from the danger which is otherwise inevitable. The matter is hazardous, and your Majesty will take it into due consideration.
The Emperor was well aware of the hazards involved. He considered too long, and the chance was lost. Mary became ill again. The summer passed, and her hopes of deliverance faded. As autumn approached, Chapuis was afraid that something sinister was in the wind. Neither he nor his servants could get access to Mary. All his inquiries and protests met with the same bland assurance from Cromwell. There was no need for anxiety about the Lady Mary, since no one was more concerned for her welfare than her own father. But Henry had tasted blood that summer, and there was no knowing what he might do next. Anne was always beside him, growing desperate as she saw his passion fade, and unable to secure her position by giving him a son. Chapuis was convinced that she would not rest until she had brought about Mary's death. Catherine, ill and despairing, was terrified that Henry meant to put Mary to the test over the oath of succession at the next Parliament. She wrote again and again to the Emperor, begging for his help. But he, far away and overburdened with kingdoms, could only reply that they must not take the oath except to save their lives. Before this letter reached her, Catherine's troubles were over. She died at Kimbolton Castle on the 7th of January, 1536. Mary's feelings can only be imagined. Her beloved mother was dead, many believed poisoned, and she had not been there to pray for her. As for Henry...
When the king received the news, he was heard to exclaim, "Thank God we are now free from any fear of war." On the following day, which was Sunday, the king dressed entirely in yellow, with the exception of a white feather in his cap. His daughter Elizabeth was triumphantly taken to church to the sound of trumpets and with great display. After dinner, the king went to the hall where the ladies were dancing and there made great demonstration of joy. At last he went into his own apartments, took the little bastard in his arms, and began to show her first to one and then another.
While Anne Boleyn appeared to rejoice at Catherine's death, she was too shrewd not to have known that, in fact, her predecessor's continued existence was the best guarantee of her own increasingly precarious situation. The king was not likely to embark on a third marriage, which would be subject to the same doubt as his second, while Catherine lived. Although he'd already begun to make tentative inquiries on the matter, he was also telling certain close friends in the strictest confidence that he'd been tricked into marrying Anne by the black arts, and therefore it was no marriage at all. In her desperation, Anne even made attempts to win the gratitude of the girl she had so deeply wronged.
According to a message received from the princess, the concubine has lately sent word through her own aunt, in whose keeping the princess still is, that should she consent to waive her obstinacy and be obedient like a dutiful daughter to her father's commands, the concubine would at once become her warmest friend and a second mother to her, and that if she wished to come to court, might walk at her side. I am also told that the governess is continually entreating the princess to consider these offers. However, the princess's answer has always been that no daughter in the world would be more obedient to her father than she herself is ready to be, provided her honor and conscience are safeguarded.
Then, at the end of January, on the very day of Catherine's funeral, Charles Wroxley wrote in his chronicle,
3 days before Candlemas, Queen Anne was brought a bed and delivered of a man-child before her time, for she said that she had reckoned herself but 15 weeks gone with child. It was said she took a fright, for the king ran that time at the ring and had a fall from his horse, but he had no hurt. And she took such a fright withal that it caused her to fall into travail, which was a great discomfort to all this realm.
According to the ill-natured, it was not so much fear for the king's safety as rage over his interest in Jane Seymour, one of her maids of honour, that had caused Anne's unlucky miscarriage, and people began to remark on Henry's growing coldness towards her. At church on Easter Sunday, Chapuys, who lost no opportunity of doing anything which might even indirectly be of assistance to Mary, still thought it worth his while to make a bow to Anne and offer her 2 candles for the religious ceremonies. As he said in a letter to a friend, "If I had seen any hope of the king's favor, I would have offered not 2 but 200 candles to the she-devil." A fortnight later, the end came.
The second day of May, about 5 of the clock at night, Queen Anne Boleyn was brought to the Tower by my Lord Chancellor, the Duke of Norfolk, Master Secretary, and Sir William Kingston, Constable of the Tower. And when she came to the court gate, she fell down on her knees before the said lords, beseeching God to help her, as she said she was not guilty of her accusement, and also desired the lords to beseech the king's grace to be good unto her. And so they left her there a prisoner.
Anne's trial was a foregone conclusion. She was charged, among other things, with adultery and incest, found guilty, and condemned to death. On the 19th of May, she was beheaded on Tower Green by a French swordsman, specially imported from Calais. One of the consequences of her death was immediate.
The 20th day of May, the king was married secretly at Chelsea in Middlesex to one Jane Seymour, daughter of Sir John Seymour, knight in the county of Wiltshire. The said Jane was first a waiting gentlewoman to Queen Catherine, and after to Anne Boleyn also. She was brought to Whitehall on the 30th day of May, and there set in the queen's seat under the canopy of estate royal.
Jane Seymour had always remained faithful to Catherine's memory, and now she publicly begged the king to send for Mary and restore her title of princess. Many people, including Mary herself, confidently expected that she would be taken back into favor now that Anne Boleyn was gone. She waited a week and then wrote to Cromwell.
Master Secretary, I would have been a suitor to you before this time to have been a means for me to the king's grace to obtain his blessing and favor. But I perceive that nobody durst speak for me as long as that woman lived, which is now gone, whom I pray our Lord of his great mercy to forgive. I am now the bolder to write, desiring you for the love of God to be a suitor for me to the king, to have his blessing, and leave to write to his grace.
Mary got the permission she asked for, and on the 1st of June she wrote to her father.
I beg in as humble and lowly a manner as a child can for your daily blessing, my chief desire in this world. I acknowledge and repent of all my offences since I first had discretion until this hour. Next unto God, I do and will submit me in all things to your goodness and pleasure, beseeching your highness to consider that I am but a woman and your child, who hath committed her soul unto God, and her body to be ordered in this world, as it shall stand in your pleasure. I rejoice to hear of the marriage between your grace and the queen now being, and my daily prayer is that God will send you shortly a prince.
Another week went by, and Mary wrote again to Cromwell.
Good Master Secretary, I think so long to hear some comfort from the king's grace, whereby I may perceive him of his princely goodness and fatherly pity, to have accepted my letter and withdrawn his displeasure from me, that nature moveth me to be so bold as to send him a token, which my servant hath to deliver to you. I beg you will find means that his highness may send me some token of his forgiveness, which shall be my greatest comfort, until I am permitted to come into his presence.
Mary was still clinging pathetically to the belief that Anne's death had changed everything, and that Henry remained at heart the good-natured, easy-going, conventionally pious father she remembered from happier days. The bitter realization that the change in him was inherent had yet to be forced on her. Cromwell now sent her the draft of an apology, which he advised her to copy and send to the king. The draft was abject enough, but in it Mary must have read a hint of the thing she feared most, that Henry still intended to make her swear to the oath of succession. For in her reply to Cromwell, she wrote,
Good Master Secretary, I send you by this bearer both the letter for the King's Highness sealed, and a copy of the same to you, whereby I trust you shall perceive that God and my conscience not offended, I have followed your counsel, and will do so in all things concerning my duty to the king's grace. Wherefore, I desire you, as my very trust is in you, that you will find such means through your great wisdom, that I be not moved to agree to any further entry into the matter. For I assure you, I have done the uttermost that my conscience will suffer me. This point accepted, neither you nor any other shall be so much desirous to have me obey the king as I shall be ready to fulfill the same. Sir, I beseech you for the love of God to take in good worth this rude letter. I would not have troubled you so much at this time, but the end of your letter caused me a little to fear that I shall have more business hereafter.
When Cromwell read his copy of Mary's apology, he withheld the sealed letter for the king, for she'd added the words, next to Almighty God, to his original, a reservation which rendered her submission worthless from Henry's point of view. Cromwell had staked a good deal on getting that submission, and now he wrote again, more sharply, sending yet another draft in which there was to be no qualification. Mary knew by now that she was in no position to quibble over a form of words, and that she would be lucky to escape with only a general submission. Neither could she afford to lose any help that Cromwell might be willing to give her. Returning his second draft, she wrote,
I see by your letters that you mislike my exception in my letter to the king. I assure you I did not mean it as you take it, for I trust that the king's goodness will not move me to do anything which should offend God and my conscience. Nevertheless, because you have exhorted me to write to his grace again, and as I cannot devise what I should write more but your own last copy without adding or diminishing, I do send you by this bearer the same, word for word. It is unsealed because I cannot endure to write another copy. Pain in my head and teeth hath troubled me so sore these 2 or 3 days, and doth yet so continue that I have very small rest, day or night. Wherefore I trust in your goodness, that you will accept this and find such means in your wisdom, that the king's grace will do the same. For I know of none to make suit unto, nor ask counsel of, but only you.
But it was not enough, and a commission headed by that figure of ill omen, the Duke of Norfolk, was sent to Mary. They brought with them, for her signature, a document in which she would explicitly acknowledge the king as supreme head of the church in England and the nullity of her parents' marriage. When she refused to sign, the behavior of the commissioners finally killed any lingering hope of an honorable reconciliation. She was such an unnatural daughter, said one, that he doubted if she was even the king's bastard. Another added, pleasantly, that were she his daughter, he would beat her to death and knock her head against a wall until it was as soft as a baked apple. They told her she'd shown herself to be a traitor and would be punished as one. At last, they said she might have 4 days to think the matter over, and ordered Lady Shelton to see that she was not left alone for a moment, day or night. In spite of this, Mary did manage to make last frantic appeals to both Chapuys and Cromwell. But Chapuys, for so long her faithful friend and ally, could not help her in this extremity, and advised her to yield to the king if she felt her life was really in danger. Trying to comfort her, he said that God looked more at the intentions than the deeds of men, and she would be better able to serve him in the future if she surrendered now. As for Cromwell, he was badly frightened. When the commission reported their failure with Mary, Henry had flown into a towering rage, directed not only at his daughter, but anyone who could be suspected of sympathizing with her or encouraging her resistance. The Privy Council was in continual session, and the king had persuaded the judges to agree that if Mary still defied him, she could be proceeded against in law. According to Chapuys, Henry was heard to swear that not only Mary should suffer, but Cromwell and many others. In his reply to Mary's last appeal, Cromwell made his feelings perfectly clear.
Madam, I have received your letters, whereby it appeareth you be in great discomfort. For answer, ye shall understand that how great soever your discomfort is, it can be no greater than mine, who hath spoken so much of your repentance and of your humble submission in all things, without exception or qualification. I am now both much ashamed of what I have said, and likewise afraid of what I have done, insomuch that what the sequel thereof shall be, God knoweth. Thus, with your folly, you undo yourself and all that wished you well. To be plain with you, madam, as God is my witness, I think you the most obstinate and obdurate woman that ever was. So I dare not open my lips to name you, unless I may have ground that it appear you were mistaken, or at the least, that you be repentant for your ingratitude, and ready to do all that you be bound unto by your duty of allegiance. Therefore, I have sent to you a certain book of articles, whereunto, if you will set your hand, you shall undoubtedly please God. Upon the receipt thereof again from you, with a letter declaring that you think in heart, as you have subscribed with hand, I shall adventure to speak again for you. If you will not with speed leave all your evil counsels, which have brought you to the point of utter undoing, I take my leave of you forever, and desire you never to write or make suit to me hereafter.
When Cromwell's letter reached her, Mary knew that she was beaten. For more than 3 years she'd fought gallantly to defend her principles and her good name. Now, ill, alone, and exhausted, she gave in.
The confession of me, the Lady Mary, made upon certain articles underwritten, in the which I do now plainly and with all mine heart declare mine inward belief. And so meaning forever to continue, without change or variance, I do most humbly beseech the King's Highness, my father, whom I have disobediently offended in the denial of the same heretofore, to forgive mine offences and take me to his most gracious mercy. First, I confess and acknowledge the King's Majesty to be my sovereign Lord and King, and do submit myself to his Highness and to all the laws and statutes of this realm, as becometh a true and faithful subject. Item. I do recognize, accept, and take the King's Highness to be supreme head on earth of the Church of England, and do utterly refuse the Bishop of Rome's pretended authority, power, and jurisdiction within this realm, heretofore usurped. Item. I do freely and frankly recognize and acknowledge that the marriage between His Majesty and my mother, the late Princess Dowager, was, by God's law and man's law, incestuous and unlawful.
Mary didn't have to wait long for the rewards of her submission. On July the 8th, Chapuys reported to the Emperor.
On the day before yesterday, the King and Queen left London early in the morning on a visit to the Princess, remaining with her until yesterday about the hour of Vespers. It is impossible to describe the King's kind behavior towards his daughter and the deep regret he said he felt at having kept her so long away from him. There was nothing but conversing with the Princess in private, and with such love and affection and such brilliant promises for the future that no father could have behaved better. The Queen presented her with a fine diamond ring, and the King put into her hand a check for about 1,000 crowns, all the time exhorting her not to trouble herself in future about money, for she would get as much as she wanted merely by applying to him. At his departure, the King told the Princess that in 3 or 4 days he would send the Secretary Cromwell and other high officials to her for the purpose of arranging at once her state and household, and that if she would only have patience for a while, he would send for her and she should reside at court.
Henry's attitude showed his unbounded relief at Mary's capitulation. The King was well aware that a good proportion of his subjects hated the new ways. Already that summer, the smaller monasteries were being suppressed, which, as Roxley noted, was the cause of great lamentation by the poor people. Until Mary herself renounced her birthright, she would have remained the natural rallying point for rebellion at home and possible invasion from abroad. But neither the improvement in her circumstances nor the knowledge that she had saved her own life, and probably many others, could console Mary in the bitterness of her remorse. She begged Chapuys to obtain a secret absolution from the Pope for what she'd done, but for one of her stubborn rectitude, not even that could really alter the fact that she had knowingly betrayed her religious faith and her mother's memory, the two things which meant most in the world to her. The memory of that betrayal, made by a frightened girl of 20, was to haunt her for the rest of her life and help to make her, as she once described herself, the most unhappy lady in Christendom.
The Most Unhappy Lady was compiled from contemporary documents by Alison Plowden and produced by Joe Burrows. It was narrated by Wilfred Thomas. Mary Tudor was played by Beryl Calder, Eustace Chapuys by Simon Lack, Thomas Cromwell by Alan Wheatley, with Catherine Salkeld as Catherine of Aragon, and Godfrey Kenton as Charles Risley. Other parts were played by Wilfred Carter, William Fox, and Humphrey Morton.